What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I'm joined by the man, the myth, the legend, Peter Dunworth. He's a recurring guest, and he brought the heat as always. He battled through a little bit of sickness as well, so big ups to Peter. We talk about the Hong Kong ETF, how traditional finance is viewing Bitcoin, and much more. So stay tuned for another action-packed episode. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, remember this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And hit that subscribe button. Tell a friend to tell a friend. Bring more people to the State of Bitcoin podcast. Big shout out to the sponsors who have made this show possible. Stampseed, the number one place for you to store your seed phrase is Stampseed. You can use promo code GreenCandle and get 15% off your entire order. Also, shout out to Bitcoin News, the number one place where I get all of my news from the Bitcoin space. That's Bitcoin News. So big ups to them. All right. Now, and get some merch, man. Get some merch. I got some Green Candle merch. I got some sick stuff going on. You guys need to check all that out. All right. Enough from me. Let's get into the show. Whoosh. Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I have recurring guest Peter Dunworth, who last time on the show, we talked about the $1 billion Bitcoin that you predicted a while ago. Now with the ETFs and with interest rates potentially coming down and the fourth halving, are you still quite as bullish where you think that, you know, we're going to get to a multiple $1 billion Bitcoin? I had to get you on to ask now that we have all these crazy factors coming in, right? I mean, we got traditional finance. We got all this other stuff coming in. So are you as bullish as ever, or are you pulling back the reins a little bit?
No way. We need to revise those numbers upwards. There's just more bullishness since I've been on. And in all seriousness, I think it's just a matter of time, how long it takes to get there. So I'm not so sure on the timing. I'm certain on the direction, but since we've last spoken, I think there's been a whole host of factors that I think are even more encouraging for Bitcoin adoption, for price appreciation, and most importantly, you know, those network effects taking place. So on a serious note, I think, you know, we talk about big numbers here, but all of the underlying factors that drive those numbers are showing positive skews. So, you know, it's hard to think bearishly, particularly at this point in time.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, obviously we were making a huge deal about the Bitcoin spot ETFs here in the U.S. But, I mean, obviously Hong Kong just released, I think it's six different spot ETFs as well. So, you know, I guess talk to me on how you're looking at the differences between the Hong Kong ETFs and the overall, like, U.S. ETFs. Do you see one as much greater than the other or much more impactful?
Yes, I do. And probably the biggest thing to come to Bitcoin is the ETF. And the reason why that's the case is it opens access to capital markets that has never been accessed before. The US has the deepest pool of liquidity, the deepest capital markets globally, and most importantly, the best property rights. So capital flight, as well as, you know, personal flight, goes to the US because of those property rights. And this is something that I think Bitcoin often gets overlooked, but the ETF is a match made in heaven for property rights in the US and capital flight to the US. Now, when it comes to the Hong Kong ETF, I don't think it's as big a deal as the US's ETF because, you know, Hong Kong is effectively a subset or a district of China now. There's no sovereignty there whatsoever. And, you know, serious capital allocators have got obvious concerns around putting their money into a capital market that has capital restrictions. And so the greatest contribution I see the Hong Kong ETF making is putting political pressure on the SEC to create in-kind contributions and withdrawals. If they can push and create the competition to facilitate that type of change to the US ETFs, then that is going to be a massive contribution that is going to further improve the service offering of the US ETFs.
Now, with that, it came out earlier that China would not initially have access to those Hong Kong ETFs. I guess China's already kind of been anti-Bitcoin, banning Bitcoin mining previously. It came out today that there's rumors that Chinese participants might be able to purchase the Hong Kong ETF products, but it's still kind of unclear at the time of this recording here on May 7th. So or I think it might be May 8th where you're at, Peter. But with all that being said, do you think that that's a huge factor trying to get into the Chinese market as well? Or is it just kind of a nothing burger because China's been so anti-Bitcoin, to this point?
And I think it's more of a nothing burger for two reasons. The bigger one being is that there's been no regulatory clarity around Bitcoin. The flipping and the flopping, and so much so that one of my favorite Bitcoin memes is the degenerate Chinese trader who sold his Bitcoin and Bitcoin's going up, and he says to his wife, "I sold my Bitcoin, it's going up." And she says, "Oh, just say China ban Bitcoin again." And he says, "Oh, I've tried that 15 times already." And his wife whispers, "But it still works." And so the skit's beautiful because he calls the Wall Street, whatever it is, and says, "Oh yeah, hello, this is the People's Bank of China. We ban Bitcoin now." And then you watch Wall Street go into panic selling Bitcoin, and it's such a joke that they flip-flopped on that regulatory certainty, and they effectively just ceded ground on that regulatory certainty and said, "We're not going to give you any of it." So no serious capital allocators are going to put money into that ETF while they have that, until they have a decent track record and a serious commitment that they're on team Bitcoin rather than anything else. Whereas, although the US has moved really slowly, they've moved deliberately, and they were very slow to give that ETF approval. But the beauty of the slow moving ETF that we've seen in the US is that now that there's regulatory certainty around it, they're not going to flip and flop and change and ban it and the rest of it. So, and we've also seen at a state level that some of the states have taken it upon themselves to ensure that you've got Bitcoin rights at a state level as well, which will hopefully supersede any national directive that comes out to ban Bitcoin. So I just think the US has a huge advantage from that perspective, that flight of capital will continue to go to the US. And tongue in cheek, people really want that in China. They got a lot of other problems that they need to deal with. That's, Bitcoin is a long way down the list of the things they want to focus on. So I think for us, we do want to focus on it. But the biggest thing I can draw out of that is the fact that it's going to allow for in-kind redemptions and contributions. And I'm hoping that puts pressure on the SEC to allow that with the ETFs in the US. But I think you remember that one of the last adjustments before the approval was that the SEC wanted to rescind the ability to do that. So they did do that. That was probably going to have some trouble with GBTC and cause problems for them. We've seen the outflow of that. And now that we've sort of seen outflows from Grayscale stop, maybe there's the ability for the SEC to revisit that and say we'll allow for that moving forward.
Yeah, I mean it's been interesting. I think before this week or this past what like maybe 6 or 7 trading days, there's basically constant inflows. I think it was like 78 straight days of straight inflows into the spot ETFs in the US. So essentially, I mean, the way it looked at it from like an outsider's looking in, it was there was with as much money that was being dumped in, it was hard to not argue that Bitcoin became Wall Street's favorite asset. Now, with that being said, there's been some outflows here recently, obviously with the recent price dip. We saw it go from, all-time high about 70K-ish to drop into 60. So not a significant drop if you've been in here for this whole bear market, but if you're just kind of coming in, right? It's a 10-15% drop or so. But regardless, Wall Street has been kind of constantly buying in. Now, I still hear that there are some bears when it comes to a Bitcoin in the traditional finance market. Have you run into any still because of your connection, kind of still in the traditional finance market, or are people still kind of coming around to you now? And this is you're seeing kind of the, I guess, the tide shift here towards more of a Bitcoin future.
I think there are going to be forever bears, which we can poke fun at, and it's probably moved to the point of, hey, we really need to be kind and help educate these people to the point now there's enough education out there we can start making fun of these people if they're so reluctant to take on any of this education that's, freely given. There are some in traditional finance that I deal with that, still are skeptical of Bitcoin and don't believe or understand what the value proposition is to it. And I think that's what makes a market continue to be wrong, hopefully for a very long time. And, that gives us the opportunity to purchase cheap Bitcoin and keep investing in it. Because if everyone understood what we understood, then we'd probably have $1 billion Bitcoin by now, but we don't. So there's still a long way to go in educating people.
Yeah, so I want to talk about the overall macro environment now, to kind of get your taste on it, because if you talk to traditional finance people, I just actually came out from my Tuesday night space, where I host like basically every Tuesday night from 8 p.m. Eastern to 10. And if you listen into a lot of those guys who are regulars, they look at all these factors. They say that the overall economy, there's nothing really significantly wrong with it. If you look at all the underlying numbers, right, the jobs reports, whatever. I actually just saw an article being published that it's the amount of rent has increased by 50% in the city of Tampa, where wages have only increased by 18%. And Tampa is where I live, but that's not super uncommon for the entire US. So obviously people are really feeling these that the inflation effect at a lower level, and it maybe it hasn't quite surfaced just yet. But yeah, I'd be curious to see kind of your overall thoughts on the market with me kind of setting the stage there. So yeah, what do you feel? Do you think we're in a recession or getting there? Like how would you kind of describe the overall macro environment?
I think it's confusing, and this is where, full disclosure here and hands up, I have somewhat given up on macro because it's like that old accounting joke. There's no authenticity, and when it comes to the numbers that we get presented, whether it's the labor stats from the Philly Fed, the unemployment numbers, or the GDP figures, or the inflation numbers from the Fed, it's like that old accounting joke. How do you know you've got a good accountant? Ask them what 1 + 1 is if they're any good. They're going to look over their shoulder. They're going to shut the blinds, and they're going to gently whisper in your ear, "What do you want it to be?" And this is where the numbers that we get presented today feels very much like that. And it feels very much like where the China numbers were 10 years ago, where, although we were presented the numbers, we all knew they were lying, and, we just adjusted accordingly. And this is where I hate to say this, and this is sounds somewhat defeatist, and the futility of actually studying the numbers and what does it all mean. Like there was a time where, I used to look at these numbers, diligently and actually come up with strategies around, well, this number means we've got to have X associated and invested in this, and this affects the portfolio allocation in this way. It doesn't matter. It's a fugazi. It's all bullshit. So whether it's good or not, it's really, how each individual reacts to that in their own time. And this is where, the really important things that we can be doing is educating people about Bitcoin, because what it does is it takes away power from that system, and it empowers you to have full control over what's happening to you in the future. And the fact that Bitcoin's the best store of purchasing power that we've got moving forward is really critical. And then if people don't understand that, then we really need to dig into why they want to have that. Because once they understand that, then it can, then you have the controls, or all the economic controls in front of you that you need to create your own outcomes that you want to. And this is where the broader macro picture, it's really confusing at the moment, because excuse me, you've got in one hand Jerome Powell basically jamming interest rates up, trying to put the brakes on. At the same time, you've got Janet Yellen, the other arm, of the body, basically piling cash into the system. And it's like, this is a very confusing time. Typically, those branches of government, the Fed and the Treasury, worked in unison to achieve the same outcome. And now they're literally counterposed. One's on the brakes, one's on the accelerator, and they're trying to achieve different outcomes. So it's very confusing as an investor to say, well, what should we be doing? But I can tell you historically that, in the last, say, 24 to 30 months, we've seen the worst long-term Treasury market we've seen in 200 years. So if you've been holding long-term bonds, you've been getting killed. And, you know, to think, is the economy really that bad? Well, I don't know if it is, but it kind of feels like inflation's ready to go on a tear again, which means rates are going to go up. And ironically, that probably means more inflation, not less inflation, because now that we've got, you know, reached critical mass with the debt levels, that, you know, any increase in the interest rate is actually going to be inflationary, not deflationary. So all of a sudden, all the tools that we've got in front of us tell us that, you know, this is just a really tricky economic situation that I don't think any of us have faced. And maybe there's maybe a handful of, you know, 70 plus year old seasoned investors who are actually familiar with this environment. But even then, that's very different to what they faced in the 70s. So I look at this and think, you know, we are in uncharted territory. And, you know, if I didn't have Bitcoin to fall back on as a safety net, boy, oh boy, I wouldn't know where to start with this macroeconomic environment and then the downstream consequences of the investment decisions that you got to make on the back of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. And I think, you know, the one beauty about Bitcoin is it makes us question everything, right? I mean, we've been questioning the data, questioning the overall system that, you know, we've, I guess, grown up in. And like you know, you were saying you were basing some strategies off of it. But I think part of the negative of Bitcoin as well, I mean, there's very few, but it opens your worldview. So you think that everything's going to crash and burn like really quickly because you've seen all the holes in the current system. But everybody else is still fairly delusional, at least from my conversations. And they think everything's, you know, kind of peaches and daisies. That's why I wanted to get your overall opinion on it, because I always just think it's an interesting kind of dichotomy between Bitcoiners and like traditional finance or even just normal people, right? I mean, I think there's like a happy medium where everybody's feeling that inflationary pressures. But, you know, for the most part, a lot of people still have their jobs or are able to find, you know, some gig work or something like that in the U.S. From friends that I know, they're able to, I guess, kind of bounce back fairly quickly. So I think you're right. It's like in some uncharted territories and there's a lot of like uncertainties ahead. But I think that makes like for a curious environment of how Bitcoin kind of performs in this. Because, you know, it's been a risk on asset, or at least viewed as a risk on asset in traditional finance. And generally speaking, when, you know, the Fed pulls back and lowers interest rates, risk on assets then shoot up. But, you know, in a time like this, you know, where there's certain economic factors that make for, I guess, water, shaky waters and whatnot, when the Fed pulls back interest rates, it leads to a recession, or at least like the previous two times has happened, right? In 2008 and in 2000. But at that point in time, we were already kind of seeing some bad things kind of fall through the cracks. I know that this is kind of a tough question putting you on the spot, but how would you think that Bitcoin would react in such an environment, in a recession? Do you think this is the time where it's essentially kind of, I guess, decouples from the stock market? Or do you think, you know, with the way things are, it's still going to kind of still follow the trends?
It depends what type of recession we have and what is the catalyst for it. And if you look at, if it's a credit crunch of any sort, then I think we're going to have Bitcoin absolutely hammered really quickly. That'll be the first asset. That's the canary in the coal mine, because it's the only accessible asset 24/7, 365. So much like March 2020, you know, the Federal Reserve had a board meeting on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock. Bitcoin proceeded to drop 20% because it was the only asset that you could sell at Sunday on a 6 p.m. in New York City that time. So I think depending on what type of recession we have, is it a credit crunch that is an instant catalyst that, you know, is potentially spawned out of commercial real estate or has something to do with residential mortgage-backed securities or commercial mortgage-backed securities? Is that the type of catalyst for it? Then I think absolutely Bitcoin's going to get hammered, but it's going to be the first to recover as well. So I look at this and think, you know, this is the real problem that whether it's normies or TradFi have with Bitcoin is they look at this and think it's risky, but it's the risk-free asset. It's just volatile. And this is where it's our best canary in the coal mine, as Luke Roman likes to describe it, that, you know, because of the volatility of it, it's typically a harbinger for what's to come. So I think if we do have a recession coming up and it's quite nasty and deep and borders on a depression, and I might just take a moment to step back and say, it's so quickly we forget what the definition of recessions are. Like, we forget that they hoodwinked us into believing that a recession wasn't two negative GDP quarters. And we just totally brushed over the fact that we had two negative GDP quarters. And for the last 100 years, we described a recession as two negative GDP quarters. But because the Biden government said, oh, no, it's got to have bad unemployment numbers with it, we went, bad unemployment numbers. Okay, let's move along. So now we're talking about this recession. But if you look technically, we've already had it a couple of years ago. And now we're just sort of recovering on the back of it. So, but to your point, do we have a recession coming up? How will it affect Bitcoin? Bitcoin's not getting out of it without getting untouched. But the promising thing about it is that it's going to recover quicker than anything else. And it's the only true market. So if you had a mark to market 24/7, 365 of every other asset, that'd probably be just as volatile as Bitcoin. It's just that, you don't have every other asset trading like Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hilarious that you brought that up because I was going to be kind of my next point too, because you talked already about the data manipulation, right? And so it's not only data manipulation that they're putting out there, but it's also definition manipulation now, right? It's like, well, the data is showing that it's a recession, but really it's not a recession, right? I mean, we've had already two quarters of negative GDP growth. The economy has been showing a lot of cracks. But Bitcoin is still kind of, I guess, remains strong in a sense, right? I mean, we did hit the all-time high before the halving. So, with the kind of like murkiness that we're talking, like, are you still fairly bullish here for the rest of this calendar year, and maybe even next year, where this, I guess, this four-year epoch cycle? Are you pretty bullish on what's ahead? I guess price action, adoption, all that kind of stuff.
I am, and I think one of the big things that often gets overlooked, everyone talks about the returns that Bitcoin had, and it was in light of a quantitative easing policy for, 13 of its 15-year lifespan. However, in the last 2 years, in very contractionary environment, monetary environment, we've seen Bitcoin absolutely smash it out of the park. We've seen rates go from 0% to 5%, and Bitcoin's basically doubled in value under that monetary environment. So I think a lot of the concerns around Bitcoin being a fair weather asset, and it's only good when the economy's expanding and we've got quantitative easing and lowering of interest rates, we can kind of put that one to bed, I think, at this point in time. So it's really unlikely we're going to see the equivalent of a 0 to 5% interest rate increase in the next 2 years. We're not going to see 5% to 20%. Touch wood, we don't see that, because that'd feel like it'd be catastrophic, but it's really unlikely. And despite in a quantitative tightening environment, Bitcoin's really done well. So when you look at the fact that we're in an election year, we've got interest rate pressure to the downside rather than the upside. We've got monetary stimulus happening. M2 money supply growth is back. We're just on the back of two out of the last 50 years that hasn't had any monetary growth. We're on the back end of we've just passed the halving. All of a sudden, we've got an ETF approval. There's a whole host of structured products that I believe will come to market in the next 18 months, 2 years, which will be, it'll make the inflows to the ETFs look like, just a dribble, drop in the bucket. In addition to that, you've got all of the network effects are happening. You've got node adoption going through the roof, hash rate on the network absolutely flying, and the miners, despite the fact they've had their revenues up. We haven't had any catastrophes there, touch wood. I expect some in the couple of months, when the reality of half their revenue is coming with the same cost base. But overall, it's a wildly popular and bullish picture for the next 18 months.
100%. And I think, it is interesting, right? I mean, we're obviously gassing up the ETFs here. But if you look at the overall market cap of the 11 Bitcoin spot ETFs in America and the overall market cap of Bitcoin, it's still only about 5%. I want to bring this up to you because, you have the traditional finance background as well. And I think I'm not quite sure the overall, I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but the overall gold spot ETFs, I believe it's like significantly more, maybe like the spot ETFs is either 30 to 60. I know that's a very wide range, but it's significantly more than the over of gold's total market cap than Bitcoin, right? But the narrative is kind of around that the ETFs are swinging and moving the Bitcoin price. Do you kind of think that's the case with the ETFs being, I guess, that small relative to the overall market cap? Or do you kind of equate the early swing from maybe more of the hype and the hodler's behavior and whatnot, just kind of some of those other factors?
I think it's a combination of two things. Obviously, it's the hard work the hodlers have done over the last 2 years in buying as much available Bitcoin supply as they can. And then that's supercharged with the, you know, effectively the demand impact that is being forced on the supply with the ETFs. And one thing that's been really positive for me to look at and, you know, talk to a whole host of people. My business partner was on a call with Kathy Wood a couple of weeks ago. My expectation was that Bitcoin was going to be adopted to the tune of 1% to 2% in client portfolios. The reason why I thought that was the case was, you know, we were doing that 8 years ago in 2016 with clients. Hey, 1% to 2% represents, you know, a small allocation. It's not a fatal mistake in your portfolio if it goes to zero. It represents effectively one day's worth of volatility in a bad market. In the stock market, this is a level of risk that we can take. But the conversation had with Kathy was that it's really, no, it's more a 3% to 5% allocation that the institutions want, which is double what I thought it would be, maybe even closer to triple. So there's that immediate acceptance of what this asset is, probably a deeper understanding of what it is. And this is where, for the first time, we now have Wall Street's incentives aligned with adding Bitcoin to the portfolio, because up until the ETFs, we weren't able to, you know, align those two interests. It was one that was very difficult to create an incentive for Wall Street to do it, because what you were doing was you were taking assets from them to put into an asset outside of the system. But now with the ETF, they can press a button and they can have 3% to 5% exposure to Bitcoin at the touch of a button. Now, is it the ideal way that I'd want to hold it moving forward? No, but it gets them to the top of the funnel, and hopefully it gets them into this rabbit hole and down it further faster, because now they've got skin in the game and they've got the ability to do that. But one thing that can't be understated here is that the advisors now have an incentive to put this into portfolios, and God bless them. And, you know, I consider myself an advisor, but very simple creatures who are motivated by self-interest. So that is the beauty of having now the ETFs, that they can advise that to clients and now benefit from advising on it.
Yeah. And I definitely think, you know, if you consider yourself a fiduciary, financial advisor, I mean, putting in the best performing asset over the past, since basically Bitcoin's inception, I mean, it's essentially a no-brainer. And I think it would be against a fiduciary's, or it would be for a fiduciary's responsibility in order to do that. So, I mean, I think more and more financial advisors, more and more institutions are going to continue to do that. And more people are going to be onboarded into Bitcoin. Now, whether or not they figure out the full intricacies of it, I think, you know, the ETFs are one touch point. But I want to talk about a different kind of tangential aspect of it, right? Because, you know, we're talking a lot about the Bitcoin ETFs, the number go up and whatnot. But we also just had, you know, creators of Whirlpool arrested in the U.S. We've had a lot of attacks on the privacy. You know, do you look at a lot of those things as potential attacks on Bitcoin, whether it's, some sort of regulation to use and hold Bitcoin outside of like these ETF products as like pretty significant? Is it just kind of, another, you know, drop in the hat, and, you know, Bitcoin's the honey badger, so it'll keep pushing on?
Ultimately, Bitcoin is the honey badger, which we'll keep pushing on. And this is where I don't think any of us as Bitcoiners like to see those sorts of things happen to Bitcoiners. I use that term loosely with Roger, but, you know, no one likes to see the US government go after an ex-citizen to say, hey, you owe us $50 million and we're going to throw you in jail until that debt gets repaid. And then on, you know, the CoinJoin stuff, you know, that's quite terrifying to think that, you know, that is a regulatory concern for the US government to say, hey, for me, it's not clear that that service did facilitate money laundering. And to me, it does look like a concerted attack on Bitcoin. Ultimately, Bitcoin will be able to recover and move forward from here with or without that. It's just I don't think anyone likes to see that, and regulatory clarity around that before those types of actions are taken, I think would be very helpful, so that people can create privacy tools without the fear of government reprisal.
Yeah, so I guess put on my little conspiratorial tinfoil hat here and see if you agree with it or if you think I'm just crazy. But in my opinion, I think the way that the US is attacking Bitcoin, if you're looking at it from the regulation side, might be smart from their aspect, which I don't like to give regulators a lot of credit, but they're attacking essentially non-custodial Lightning wallets. So like Wallet of Satoshi, Moon, like all those. And then they're essentially either, making it very difficult to buy Bitcoin on a place where you can hold it non-custodially, right? And hold it without utilizing KYC, at least in the US, right? So in order to transact with a business or send to a friend, majority of the time, you're going to have to use an app like Cash App or Strike now, which are both KYC. And then, obviously, Bitcoin's got its full blockchain ledger that, tracks every single transaction. So, one, if you ever really wanted to kind of escape that, you would maybe have to pay high on-chain fees, or two, you would have to essentially just go through KYC, and they're going to make it very difficult for the average person to go non-KYC. And so because of all that, they'll be able to track everything. So that's why and guess who would love to track everything as a potential taxable event is the IRS. Down the line, that's when the tax man is going to potentially come knocking. But anyway, regardless, I think that they're trying to make it more difficult for you to hold and use Bitcoin, one, without KYC, and two, kind of encouraging people to go towards the traditional finance tools like the ETFs, just because, it's more difficult to hold it by yourself. Now, do you think I'm crazy, or do you kind of see where I'm coming from here?
I don't think you're crazy. It
It's okay to
looks,
tell me that I am.
yeah. Well, no, I don't think you are. I think, it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, probably is a duck. So, and this is where, without going into that rabbit hole too deeply, the two other functions of money, which I spend a lot of my time focusing on, is store of value and unit of account. And just on a relative value basis, and a value proposition, I know a lot of the development on the network is focused on medium of exchange and really displacing that US dollar. And I'm very supportive of anyone who's working in that space, but I have a different focus, long-term wealth and, ensuring intergenerational transfer of Bitcoin. Now, when it comes to value accretion, if I look at those three modules of functions of money, store of value might be somewhere between 15 trillion to 300 trillion. Medium of exchange is a $100 trillion market, and the unit of account's a $2,000 trillion market. Removing all concern around the medium of exchange, you still get to capture 95% or more of the value of the entire globe by going after store of value and medium of exchange. And most importantly, there's no gatekeepers there, such as the US government, the FBI, the CIA, the US military, or any other government body to stop you as a store of value or a unit of account when it comes to the use of Bitcoin. And I look at this and I think it's really hard focusing on medium of exchange. I want those tools there, but in the long-term scheme of things, you win store of value, win unit of account. By default, you get medium of exchange. And this is where, on the full circle of, what we do, where from a business perspective, we're all about KYC coins. So I often don't enter into those conversations around non-KYC coins with clients because, for two reasons really. Firstly, the Bitcoin blockchain is an immutable ledger, meaning that ledger is never going to change. And when you fold on top that the chain analytics of the world companies are going to get continually better at chain analysis, you're expected to outrun your non-KYC Bitcoin from the authorities forever. I'm like, that sounds like an exhausting task. To me, I'm like, I've got KYC Bitcoin and it's KYC'd and this is everything, for the reason that, I think at some point in time the IRS is going to want to clamp down on a whole host of things. And, if they find things that you haven't disclosed, that's not a finable offence, that's a jailable offence. And that's something that, absolutely terrifies me, the thought of, making a mistake on your tax return and being thrown in jail for it. And it could have been an honest mistake. And you think, one of the greatest American gangsters who, absolutely ruled the roost and, got away with murder, literally. How'd they get him? They got him on tax fraud, Al Capone. Like, the IRS is ruthless. Taking on that behemoth is, I think it's, hey, good luck to you if you want that challenge. But that's something that, I am rightly terrified of.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny you say that about Al Capone, because I think I was watching a Netflix documentary called The Cocaine Cowboys here recently, which is about like a couple friends in Miami who, they did the whole drug trade cocaine thing. And in the end, I think they end up getting them for writing fake checks and then for avoiding taxes as well, where basically the reasoning was there was a conspiracy, because I mean, if you look at the tax law, it says that no matter what, how you got that money. So even if you got that money illegally, you need to pay taxes on it. And so there was evidence that they had a lot of money, but they didn't pay taxes on it. So it was assumed that they got the money illegally. They couldn't prove how they did it, but they just know that they didn't pay taxes on it. So that's how the government gets them. I mean, it's crazy. The tax man's always going to come knocking. But I think that kind of leads me to what you do with collaborative custody and kind of protecting yourself from not only like potentially, I guess, like, counterparty risk with the ETFs, like the SEC and all that kind of, controlling it and kind of pulling the strings. But, I guess, how important do you see collaborative custody and these type of models kind of improving not only how people hold Bitcoin, but, how they view it as, a store of value going forward?
I think collaborative custody has a huge role to play in the broader adoption of self-custody. And I think it is a great entry point for anyone who's new to Bitcoin to work with a number of institutions in that collaborative format to help avoid any of the catastrophic failures that you may face by self-custodying at 100% yourself. And I look at, just statistically speaking, if you look at the number of lost coins in the network, there might be somewhere between 4 and 5 million coins. How have they been lost? It's all been through self-custody. So that's a major effort that I think the fear and concern around self-custodying should be paramount, because it's a digital bearer instrument, which if you don't get it right and you do muck up, there's no recourse, there's no one to call. And this is something over the last 8 years we've worked with clients to do that, to help avoid those catastrophic failures. We haven't lost a single Bitcoin, and we've been through 3 probates now where clients have sadly passed away, but we've been able to safely transfer their self-custody Bitcoin to their loved ones and their estate so that their beneficiaries can benefit from the sacrifices that they've made. And this is where I look at collaborative custody as a great way to get people at the top of the funnel into self-custody without making any of the mistakes that's going to cost them on a long-term basis. And I look at this much like the way when you go to 10-pin bowling and you go with the kids and you've got those little bumpers that you can pull out so that the kids don't, basically roll a gutter ball and get zero. And I look at the collaborative custody environment. You get to leverage off professionals in the space with someone who's never self-custodied their Bitcoin before. And, they can throw the ball down the alleyway and it can hit every bumper along the way. And, they're not going to hurt themselves. They're not going to lose any Bitcoin. And at some point in time, they're going to get the ball to the other end of the alley where it's going to knock over some pins. And I look at that as a great starting point for, starting your self-custody journey, because, there's no solutions, only trade-offs, and you've got to find what works for you. And to anyone who's watching this and has their own setup and probably screaming at the screen right now, not your keys, not your coins, I agree wholeheartedly with that. But another analogy I like to use is, when you start surfing, you're not going to take a beginner out the back of Waimea Bay and push them into a 25-foot wave, which is how self-custody looks to a lot of people when they're first starting. You know, we'd probably start off at Waikiki, push you into a couple of 1 to 2 foot waves, practice on standing on a, you know, 12 foot board that you can't fall off. You'd probably have a meal on it if you tried, and then work your way up to, you know, self-custody, surfing out the back of Waimea in 25 foot waves. But the most important thing is that if they're here, make sure they don't muck up along the way to, you know, I guess what do we call it? Tuition fees. You know, we try and want to avoid clients paying any tuition fees that they'd otherwise have to pay from, you know, doing it all themselves.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, as people kind of learn more about Bitcoin, right? I mean, I think the ETF is one touch point, as I kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, but, you know, I think the multiple touch points and then them buying it, they're going to start to look into it more. I mean, I know I did that. You know, I looked into Bitcoin originally. I was buying on Robinhood, and in those days you couldn't pull it off an exchange. Luckily they changed that. As soon as they did, I pulled it right off. But, you know, the whole initial thing, I was like, you know, I'd rather have Robinhood kind of hold my Bitcoin, right? I mean, it's easier. And then you kind of get down the rabbit hole and you're like, oh, wait, you know, FTX happened, Celsius happened, Mt. Gox happened, like all these things happened. Like, I just want to make sure that everything is, you know, I'm dotting my I's and crossing my T's, because, you know, yeah, like you said, like losing your wealth and your kind of your savings account and everything like that, having it at the fingertips of somebody else is pretty daunting task. But the collaborative custody model, I just think just makes so much sense, especially when you want to, you know, you're going to want to put some away for retirement or for, you know, something else, right? I mean, a death, estate planning, like all those things. But, you know, Bitcoiners are also kind of crazy psychopaths. They're like, all right, I'm going to go down with this ship no matter what happens. But, you know, I think after some time, you think about kind of like, I guess, the planning aspect of it and the development of collaborative custody. So, you know, with all that being said, you know, with the estate planning, obviously everything, you know, with the potential of death and all that, you know, all the obvious selling points of collaborative custody, you know, what do you think, like, what are the biggest, I guess, like drawbacks or people that are criticisms that you get when it comes to bringing it up? I mean, I know you already kind of mentioned the not your keys, not your coins, but, you know, I guess obviously the argument of that is like, if you lose your keys or you die, right? I mean, what's somebody else going to do? So, yeah, what are some of the other like big arguments that you hear people making against collaborative custody?
I think one of them that is somewhat of a valid point to some Bitcoiners is that some people don't want to pay for a service, in which case I completely understand that. And, you know, for that reason, we make all of our services available online for free. So all of our IP is posted. You can literally rip off our entire collaborative custody protocol and implement that yourself if you've got the skills to do that. And we would never want anyone to not upgrade their self-custody security because they didn't want to pay for something. I think despite the fact that there is a fee to it, there is some value attached to it that, you know, avoiding tuition fees is a very big part of, you know, some of the benefits. And then the peace of mind that goes with having all of your Bitcoin locked down beyond the reach of, you know, any failure that you can create or conjure up yourself is of critical importance. So I think probably the ability to do it yourself is one of the criticisms that we've got. And if you think about it from a logical standpoint, the removal of every single point of failure, and this is where, you know, the service we deliver is literally the only one in the globe that does remove every single point of failure. The ability to do that for someone's self-custody Bitcoin is enormously beneficial. And this is where you cannot remove every single point of failure from your own self-custody setup by default without working with other professionals. So I think that's something that's really important to consider, that, you know, is probably a criticism that we get. The other one that we get is the fear of collusion with the multi-sig providers, that people think, oh, well, are you going to collude with, you know, the multi-sig providers? And it's like, well, despite the fact that I can hand on heart tell you that it's impossible for us to do that, even if it were possible to do it, it would be a very short-lived business. on both parties, both the multi-sig provider and our part. In addition to that, there are some key innovations coming to Bitcoin multi-sig, which I'm really excited about, which I think will once and for all put any of those concerns beyond any clients' concerns, in that in the very near future, probably in the next 2 to 4 years, we're going to have a effectively smart multi-sigs where you can have the client key as the master key, a programmable multi-sig, and then you can have that in a decaying multi-sig format where after 6 months, if there's no action on that key, we can degrade that to a standard two of three. And what that does is that gives the client peace of mind that it's cryptographically verifiable, that there's no chance of collusion. And to me, that's the ultimate form of proof. You know, in light of what we've been through in the last 4 years with all of our institutions, whether it's financial or health institutions, it feels like, or our government's lying to us and gaslighting us at every step. The fact that we'll be able to cryptographically verify that there's no chance of collusion will be a huge peace of mind to all of our clients.
Yeah, and I mean, I hear that as well, right? I mean, you know, that's always the main question, right? I mean, is like collusion or whatever. It's like you have to trust somebody at a certain point. And, you know, the big mantra of Bitcoin is like, don't trust verify, right? So, but I think, you know, a lot of developments are being made in order to make this more of a, you know, a model that, you know, people can really understand, and a model that people can really feel safe with. So, I mean, I think there's awesome and big things ahead. But, you know, with all that being said and you know, the big developments coming in, I gotta know, like, what's making you the most bullish going forward here? I'll steal one from and tip the cap to my good friend BTC Sessions. Nice. So why are we so bullish with, you know, all the negatives that we've lined out, you know, the potential recession, are we in a recession, all that? Why are you still so bullish here on this orange funny internet money that we got?
Yeah, I think the ETFs is the biggest thing to happen to Bitcoin, and will be financially for a long time to come. We haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the volumes that can come from the broader financial community with this. And once they really start, you know, getting some grip, and rather than turning their wheels, which is what they're doing at the moment, boy, oh boy, it's just going to be an inflow. And, you know, you take a step back and look at the broader picture on that. You're going to have funds flowing out of the bond markets, because that's typically your boomers who are taking money out to live. And you've got all the people who are accumulating money in their pension. And the majority of that will probably end up going to, you know, Bitcoin ETFs. And so we'll have a stable bid under Bitcoin, which will just be a passive set of flows that's coming to this space. And then when you couple the fact that we'll probably have structured products in the next 12 to 18 months, which will, you know, if you think the ETFs are good, wait until the structured product guys get a chance to combine ETFs with, or Bitcoin ETFs with US treasuries. This will supercharge volumes, and, you know, it could 10x, 20x the volumes that we're seeing from, you know, the ETFs now. So it's really, in light of just how tight supply is, how much demand's coming, even with that very simple knowledge, it's impossible not to be bullish over the next 12 to 24 months. So look into that if you're, you know, if you're having any doubt.
100%. And I think, you know, the digital scarcity aspect, like, nobody's really seen a scarce asset like Bitcoin, especially on Wall Street. So, you know, I just don't think the human mind can really comprehend, like, how scarce Bitcoin is. And, you know, I think with that, it's just going to be, you know, upwards and onwards. So I'm really excited for this future that we got going on here. But Peter, I really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with me here again. So why don't you tell people where they could find you? And yeah, tell people a little bit about the Bitcoin Advisor as well.
Thank you. I can be found at X on Peter BTC Advisor with an ER. Online, you can find me at thebitcoinadvisor.com with an ER. Shoot me an email. Happy to help in any way, shape or form. But what we do at the Bitcoin Advisor, our overarching mission is to get every Bitcoin off exchange. So if you're having any concerns around self-custody and how to do that safely or in the best way possible, please book a meeting with myself or the team. We're over 30 advisors now who are, you know, happy to help and talk to you about anything to do with self-custody. So take action, and ironically, you know, taking self-custody is about the most bullish thing that we can all do to ensure that the price goes up. So that's our mission. And if you need any help with it, please let us know.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it on there, right? I think the 60% of wallets with over one coin that haven't moved in well over a year. I think it's the reason we're going to see the number go up is because of you psychopaths. So I appreciate you guys all tuning in. And Peter, thanks so much, man.
Thank you, Brandon. Keep crushing it.